Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Boeing's new plane is more nightmare than Dreamliner. There was another fire today. We'll do the life and times of a Wall Street icon, and we'll wrap up the week as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 12th of July. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. All right, go ahead and chalk up another week in the American economy, huh? A little Bernanke, some news of banks, a couple of other things. Fodder, I would say, for 4.5 minutes of live radio to wrap things up with. Lee Gallagher is here from Fortune Magazine. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Cardiff? No? All right. Well, we'll go without Cardiff Garcia. Lee, I guess it's just you and me. So listen, let's talk.
All right,
we can do this. Let's talk banks, shall we? Let's talk J.P. Morgan Chase. Jamie Dimon reported earnings this quarter, this morning, $6.5 billion, even with rising interest rates. Can we say the banks are healthy?
Well, it's sort of a twofold story. I mean, J.P. Morgan's results were really strong.
I'm here.
Cardiff's here.
There he is.
All right. Well,
sorry, guys.
No worries. Thanks for coming to class. We appreciate it. So J.P. Morgan, we were talking about Cardiff and earnings. Lee, go ahead.
So they were strong. There are issues in the banking sector. You know, the quality of the earnings, as they say, is not as good as it would seem. Net interest income, which is what is the sort of like the crucial gauge of bank profitability, is on the decline. Loan balances are falling. But at J.P. Morgan, their balances are rising. So they're also focusing more on asset management and less on trading, which is what got everyone into so much trouble, but which was hugely profitable. So you know, it does look pretty strong for J.P. Morgan today.
Cardiff, you agree J.P. Morgan is strong and thus banks are strong?
Yeah, I agree with that generally. And I think it's important to remember that J.P. Morgan's activities touch almost every part of the American economy.
Yeah.
So to the extent that the U.S. economy as a whole is doing pretty well or at least getting better, and it is, J.P. Morgan's going to make a lot of money. And, you know, from quarter to quarter, the specific activities that make it a lot of money will vary. But so long as it doesn't lose track of what one of its traders in London is doing, like with the whale trade, then, yeah they're going to make money.
All right. Senator Elizabeth Warren, the scourge of Wall Street, if you will, has come out this week and said she wants to reinstate Glass-Steagall. She's the bill that separated the two halves of the banking industry from each other. Cardiff, first of all, odds of that actually happening, and B, what would it actually mean, do you think?
Very, very long shot of it actually happening. I mean, this is I think, what you might refer to as gesture politics, as some people were labeling it earlier today. Here's the problem, is that the crisis that we just got out of was precipitated by banks that were separate from commercial banks. It was precipitated by investment banks. So I don't think there's going to be a very strong political push for this. I think this is a play by Elizabeth Warren to try and get people just to start talking about some of the things that banks get up to try and point out some of the riskier elements of banks, and to try to emphasize that there are some aspects of banking that are too important to Main Street to let Wall Street try to jeopardize. So I think it's a political play, but it might be a pretty effective one given her actual aims.
All right. Hey, Lee, so Ben Bernanke gave a speech, Tuesday, Wednesday afternoon after the close, in which he spent a lot of time sort of walking himself back. If you remember last time he had a press conference, the markets went bananas. And this time he specifically came out and said, you know what? Calm down, everybody. We're going to keep rates as low as we can for as long as we can. The markets clearly now believe him, right? And they are confident in what the Fed is saying?
Yeah. And this is now, I mean, this market has a one-track mind. I mean, if you look historically, the Fed has come so far just in terms of using communication as almost policy. But it is like, you know, it's catnip. It's and everybody, you know, pick whatever analogy you want. The market's on steroids. It's going to be, you know, the whole scare was that it was going to be taken away from its methadone or whatever. It's not a sugar high, but
whatever the markets are on.
They're all true. This is what the market is living and dying on. So it's not at all surprising that the rally that we saw.
All right. Hey, Cardiff, who do you like to succeed Mr. Bernanke? Assume he does not get reappointed. There's been some murmurings this week of Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, former key advisor to President Obama. Are you buying that at all?
I'm not buying that, at least not yet. I'm saying it's Janet Yellen. I think she's wonderfully qualified. She's the number two at the Fed. She's wonderfully qualified. And even more to the point, I think she's sort of in lockstep with Ben Bernanke. And right now, the last thing I think we want is a lot of disruption. I think Obama knows that. And she's, I think, still the preferred candidate.
Lee, let me get you on the record before we go.
I think she's it. I think the number two would probably be Alan Krueger, who isn't widely known. But I mean, I think by all accounts, it's going to be Yellen. But he would be my pick for the number two.
Yeah, Krueger just formally at the White House. All right, we got to go. Lee Gallagher from Fortune magazine and Cardiff Garcia from FD Alphaville. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. At the corner of Wall Street and Broad today, those markets, things were a little choppy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This was not a good day for Boeing, not a good day at all. An Ethiopian Airlines 787 Dreamliner was sitting empty on the tarmac at Heathrow Airport in London, minding its own business when it caught fire. No passengers, no injuries, but pretty much the last thing Boeing needed to happen to a plane that was grounded worldwide back in January. It was the batteries, you'll remember back then. Today's incident is still under investigation, as they say, but traders wasted no time. They drove Boeing stock down almost 5% by the close. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has our story.
It may or may not be the batteries this time, but right now it doesn't matter. Seth Kaplan is managing partner of Airline Weekly.
And this, at this point, sort of feels like, well, what's next? And that's not a good feeling for anybody involved, airlines, passengers, or, of course, Boeing.
Ironically, passengers are the least of Boeing's concerns.
The public has a very short-term memory when it comes to stuff in the airline industry.
Bob Herbst is founder of AirlineFinancials.com.
You can go and look at history, and a month or two after these problems, for every airline, they're at new record load factors.
The question is whether airlines want to put their name behind a model with problems, says Kaplan.
Right now, if you're an airline about to perhaps order some 787s, you know, certainly you're aware of what's happening and, you know, you're taking all this into very careful consideration.
If the Dreamliners are grounded again, and that is an if, then the cost would really start to mount, says Herbst.
It would have, I will say, it'll have measurable financial consequences to Boeing. You can get away with what happened once, but I don't think Boeing will get away with it again.
Not just because of potentially fewer orders, but Boeing would have to, again, pay airlines or lend them other planes. Herbst says they'd also have to pay airlines for grounded pilots who'd spent 6 to 7 months training on Dreamliners. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
In Washington this week, there's been talk of the farm bill and student loans and immigration reform, talk being the operative word there. There's a huge backlog of unfinished business in Congress. Lawmakers, and one uses that term loosely, will be gone on recess most of next month. And the lack of legislative action does come with some economic consequences, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Now, it isn't like Congress hasn't passed any legislation. It did approve the all-important Commemorative Coin Act, but it keeps passing the buck on the big stuff, like immigration reform. An immigration bill did get through the Senate, but the House is hesitating, and some say that's hurting the economy.
The costs are very high.
That's Georgetown public policy professor Harry Holzer. He says documented immigrants would be a moneymaker.
They would pay the full range of taxes on their income, and that would be a big net plus, and the numbers were quite striking on that.
The numbers Holzer is talking about come from the Congressional Budget Office, which estimates the Senate immigration bill would increase GDP by more than 3% over 10 years. Other unfinished legislation would have a direct effect on consumers. Take the farm bill.
Economically, the pain here would be enormous.
That's Brad Lubin, who teaches agricultural policy at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says if Congress doesn't pass a new farm bill by this fall, we'll revert to 1940s-era farm policy that would double the price of a gallon of milk.
instead of $3 a gallon, they're $6 to $8 a gallon in the grocery store.
Students could also get creamed by congressional inaction. Federal student loan rates automatically doubled this month after Congress missed a deadline. Pauline Abernathy is vice president of the Institute for College Access and Success. She says if Congress doesn't act, students will take a hit.
It will cost students who enter college this year about $1,000 more over the life of their loan.
So all the political theater in Washington may be entertaining, but it isn't cheap for any of us. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
You know how when you go to the doctor, you have to spend time filling out forms and updating your insurance and figuring out your copay, and then maybe you don't get as much time with the doc as you want? Bad as all that is for patients, it makes doctors crazy, too. So thousands of them have ditched insurance payments and started taking their cue from luxury hotels. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman charts the rise of concierge care.
Gus Bates had had enough. Enough standing in lines, enough copayments, and enough reminding his physician who he actually is. Then he heard about a doctor with a different kind of practice.
It's like the Little House on the Prairie medicine, where the doctor, you have a one-on-one relationship with your physician.
Call it boutique care, direct primary care. It's best known as concierge care. Generally, patients pay a monthly fee like a gym membership. And what do they get? A physical and access to their doctor 24/7. It's the second time this week Gus Bates has seen his doctor in Fort Worth.
I know his house. He knows my house. He's been over. I have told him everything where before. I didn't tell a doctor everything. I'm not going to get through. Do you take Tylenol PM every night? Yeah, whatever, bud. He has coaxed it out of me to where he knows my everything.
Of course, this kind of care is expensive. Bates can afford $1,700 a year for service. His wife pays a bit less. They also pay for high-deductible insurance to cover anything their concierge doctor can't, like emergency care.
The consumer looks and says, you know, is this worth it to me?
That's Chris Ewan, Bates' doctor. He says not having to deal with HMOs and paperwork saves a lot of money.
Today, I don't nickel and dime them. EKGs, urine, spirometry, all the testing I do here, I don't have to go through a bean counter through the insurance company and the government. Therefore, I get the cost down.
Across the country, 4,000 doctors offer concierge care. That's 30% more than last year. It's growing fastest in states like Texas, California, and Florida.
Of course, it's attractive to physicians who go from maybe 3,000 patients down to 600. You know, who wouldn't want to do that?
Sandra Carnahan is a professor at South Texas College of Law.
In my opinion, it's really substantially more about the doctor wanting more money and a better quality of life than it is about better patient care.
So does concierge care keep patients healthier? There's not much research, but one Tufts University study shows patients do receive better service and faster referrals to specialists. The other big question is where concierge fits in once more people have insurance under Obamacare. Dr. Ewan isn't worried.
Even if you have insurance, you still don't have access to care. You can have all the insurance you want. You still can't get in to see the doctor.
Which is why thousands of people are willing to shell out thousands of dollars a year to have their doctor's cell phone on speed dial. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Coming up, the life and times of the Bull of Wall Street.
The fascinating thing about the bull is how history intersects him on so many levels.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ended at 15,464 today. That is up 3 points, not even worth mentioning percentage-wise. The Nasdaq added 21 points, about 0.6%, ended things at 3,600 even. The S&P 500 up 5 points, about 0.3%, closed at 1680. For the week gone by, the Dow up 2%, the Nasdaq powered up 3.5%. The S&P 500 added 3% as well. Wells Fargo put on 1.8% today. J.P. Morgan, despite that earnings report we were talking about, fell 0.3% on this Friday. Shipping giant UPS lowered its second quarter forecast today, blaming a slowing U.S. economy. That's not good. Shares in the world's biggest package delivery company dropped 5.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for June. President Obama welcomes former President George H.W. Bush to the White House to honor his Points of Light volunteer program. And the Sharknado of dessert pastries is scheduled to return to store shelves everywhere. Brace yourselves for the Twinkie. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This coming week is going to be a rough one in Greece. Mayors from across that country announced today they are going to suspend municipal services, government offices, garbage collection, those kinds of things, for 3 days to protest another round of austerity-induced layoffs. It's local officials calling the strikes this time, not the unions, which we figured made it a good moment to ask our very favorite question.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
Giorgos Christidis works for Germany's Der Spiegel Online. He's in Thessaloniki. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
There was good news and bad news from the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, this week. They said there's enough money in the bailout fund to keep Greece going until next summer or close to it.
Mm-hmm.
The catch, of course, is that you guys have to continue with the austerity, with the layoffs and with the budget cuts and with the higher taxes. That must have been greeted with somewhat mixed emotions.
Yes, well, first of all, I don't think there's anyone in Greece who believes that our creditors would stop lending Greece. I don't think anyone wants a failed state in Europe right now. But still, austerity is very harsh. Greece has already lost a quarter of its GDP over the crisis years. Unemployment is at 30%. And no one says that there's any light at the end of the tunnel. There's some talk about Greece returning to growth in 2014, but we have heard this too many times before.
What does 30% unemployment feel like? I mean, when you go out on the streets, there must be just people standing and sitting around with nothing to do.
You know, it's very hard to just go out with friends or relatives, and most of the times the people who are unemployed have the majority at the table, you know. And despite not having any violent protests or very intense social strife, as some would fear 3 years ago, I think if things don't improve radically and very soon, then the Argentine scenario that's been played in Greece over the past 3 years might actually materialize.
Which is default on debt and complete restructuring of the economy. I mean, Argentina 10, 12 years ago was a mess.
Yes, I believe that the government, at least, is very hopeful that after the Germans are over with their election in September, then they will sit on the table and be willing to talk about cutting Greece's official debt.
It's kind of interesting, don't you think, that Greeks are probably paying more attention to German elections coming up than they have to most recent Greek elections.
Yes, I think it's obvious to everyone living in Greece that most of the major decisions are being made in Brussels, Washington, and most importantly, Berlin. This is why many people feel, in addition to the economic hardship, they feel that they're being insulted as well in this way that you describe.
What happens, Giorgos, do you think, if this just keeps going like this? I mean, you guys have been in this for 3 years now, and it's a repetition of the same story time and time again.
This September will be the most crucial stage of the crisis yet. I think people are clinging on to this last, you know, thread of hope. If this hope does not materialize, then I'm not sure how much longer this can continue.
Giorgos Christidis is a correspondent for Germany's Spiegel Online. We got him in Thessaloniki today. Giorgos, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are big problems down on the farm, hog farms to be precise. There's a new and deadly virus that's killed hundreds of thousands of pigs in at least 16 states the past 3 months. It's not, repeat, not harmful to humans. But as Sarah McCammon reports, that said, it's meant big expenses and big headaches for hog farmers, and not just the ones with the sick pigs.
In the industry, it's called PED, porcine epidemic diarrhea virus. It's as nasty as it sounds and usually fatal for newborn piglets.
Even adults can have vomiting, diarrhea. It's not what you would call a pleasant experience, I guess.
Craig Rolls owns a large hog business spread around a 40-mile radius in western Iowa. His pigs haven't gotten the virus, and he's trying to keep it that way. We visit a barn full of recently weaned piglets, but before I can go in, I'm issued a pair of plastic booties and white disposable coveralls, never used before and thrown in a dumpster on the way out. As we step inside, Rolls says the procedures are even tighter for his employees.
They have boots that they'll wear outside the barn, and when they get to the door, they'll remove those shoes and put on a pair of boots that's designated for just inside the barn.
The virus can spread when a pig ingests even a trace amount of manure from a sick pig. It can move from farm to farm on tires or the soles of shoes. So Roll says he's stepped up his biosecurity procedures, more hand washing, assigning specific trucks to each farm, extra steps to disinfect trucks and trailers. The procedure costs as much as $500 per vehicle. It might all sound a little paranoid, but Rolls estimates that if the virus hit a single farm where pregnant sows give birth, the loss of their piglets would add up to nearly $200,000.
I've got three sow farms. If they all got hit, now you're at $600,000. That's a lot of money to me.
Genetic testing points to China as the source of the virus, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture is trying to pinpoint the exact pathway into the United States. Dr. Greg Stevenson is a veterinary pathologist at Iowa State University. His lab confirmed the first case this year. He says if this virus got in, he's worried that other, more serious diseases could too.
What is unusual about this is how quickly it appeared in multiple pretty well-managed biosecure farms over such a large geographic area, which causes people to wonder whether it was transmitted in kind of more conventional terms or whether it actually got on the farms through a feed source.
Stevenson is working with the USDA to test samples from farms around the country. Officials are talking to farmers with positive tests, asking for details like the type and number of pigs, what kind of food they eat, and where the animals have been. Agricultural economist Steve Meyer is a consultant to the National Pork Board. He estimates the virus has killed at least 500,000 pigs. Bad for farmers, but Meyer says maybe not such a big deal for your average pork chop eater.
As bad as this is, from a market standpoint, we haven't lost a very large percentage of pigs, so I don't know that we've had a lot of price impact yet.
Already, Mexico has banned the importation of live hogs. That's just the kind of move the industry wants to avoid. In Des Moines, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
We talk about Wall Street often enough on this program, from afar, mostly tracking the ups and the downs, the comings and the goings. But for the past 23 years, there's been an up-close observer right nearby, day and night, weekends and holidays. It's the Charging Bull of Wall Street, the 7,000-pound bronze sculpture that sits just a couple of blocks south of the New York Stock Exchange. His story is told in a new short film by Mark Nicholas. Mark, it's really good to have you here.
Thank you, Kai.
I'm embarrassed to say that I did not know until I watched your film that this bull only has been there since 1989.
Right. And he's still just a temporary installation. I think there's a city ordinance that says you can't have a private work of art that is on public property for more than a year. And I think they've just turned a blind eye to that rule. But yeah, he's only been there since 89. And he sits right there on Lower Broadway on the Canyon of Heroes. So I thought, you know, imagine his life. I thought, you know, could somebody do a short film about him from his point of view?
Not to personify this bull too much, but he's kind of annoyed that he became sort of the symbol of all that is wrong and evil with Wall Street. You have him talking about this at one point.
I was born as a defiant act of self-expression against government, and Wall Street had no use for me back then. They had me carted off.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to not make it sort of like taking sides politically, but I did think by personifying him, it is sort of ironic that, you know, given that he was put on a truck and carted off to a warehouse in Queens at the beginning of his life, that he's now the target of protesters. And I thought that there would be this sort of sense of, you know, the sort of incredulous sense of how is this happening to me? How am I penned in? And the fact that the Occupy protests actually began in Vancouver, Canada. And so I think, like, from his point of view as a New Yorker, there's this sense of, you know, how could you target me? I began as a work of art, and who's Canada to be lecturing us about protesting government?
I love the way you refer to this 7,000-pound bronze sculpture as an actual person. I think that's actually great.
Thank you.
This bull just showed up in the middle of the night. It was a gift from the sculptor.
Yeah, it was. He spent several hundred thousand dollars of his own money to make it. And he and some friends decided that they were going to drop it off under a Christmas tree right near Wall Street, right near the Stock Exchange. It was a gift to the U.S. It wasn't a gift to Wall Street. It was a gift to all of the country for its strength and for all that it's done. And in the morning, when the Wall Street folks got to work, they wanted it gone. I mean, they called NYPD and asked that it be taken away, which is sort of the great irony here is Wall Street had no use for him back then.
This thing has seen all kinds of history go by it. He's right there in the Canyon of Heroes, ticker tape parades. My favorite part, of course, is where he's talking about all the champions he's seen go by, the Yankees.
Since then, the Yankees have come by five times, the Giants twice, and even the Rangers, shockingly.
And the fascinating thing about the bull is how history intersects him on so many levels, from the tragedy of 9/11 to the Occupy protests to all the celebrations of the ticker tape parades to now sort of the rebirth of Lower Manhattan. And this guy has been there through the whole thing, and I think it's remarkable.
Mark Nicholas, his film about the Wall Street Bull is called My Life in the Canyon of Heroes. It's one of 24 finalists in a Smithsonian contest for short films. It's called In Motion. Mark, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
The winner will be announced Monday, by the way, in that contest. You can watch the movie The Charging Bull of Wall Street on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which, honestly, I just can't, really. A survey from a mobile payments company called Jumio. They do a study called Mobile Consumer Habits, from which we learned today that 1 in 10 American adults use their smartphones during sex. Among 18 to 34-year-olds, it's 1 in 5. 20% of those people left happily unreported was how their partners feel about it. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 3 points. The NASDAQ added 22 points, about 0.6%. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.